At the heart of the latest work from acclaimed philosopher and novelist Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein lies one question. Is philosophy obsolete? In Plato at the Googleplex, Goldstein proves why philosophy is here to stay, and in fact, more relevant today than ever before, by revealing its hidden, though essential, role in today's debates on religion, morality, politics, and science. It's a great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
What got you thinking about this, of looking at the role of philosophy in our current society and its necessity?
Well, I come from a scientific background. It was really philosophy of science that I was trained in. And I hang around mostly scientists, a good deal of evolutionary biologists and physicists, cosmologists. And something I'm constantly hearing, it's almost a cliche taken for granted in those circles, is that philosophy never makes any progress, that philosophers are just there to raise the questions and kind of waste our time, speculating until the scientists arrive on the scene, like the cavalry, and, you know, for the empirical techniques of science to catch up. And then progress is made, but philosophy itself is really the art of asking premature and therefore futile questions. And I think this is wrong, and that's what really set me off to what's the best way to argue this this conclusion.
I have to say,
wrong.
I guess I'm somewhat naive because I never knew that was a really valid argument that perhaps philosophy was obsolete.
Yeah, oh, aren't you lucky? I hear it all the time.
Really? In what matter?
Physics and cosmology started as natural philosophy. You know, it was the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, who raised all of these questions. And then, it was even an ancient Greek, Democritus, who came up with the idea of the atom. And, but it wasn't scientific yet. It was purely speculative. And so, and the same thing happened with psychology and with linguistics and with even computer science, even with logic. These were all parts of philosophy, but then as the methodology caught up, they were taken out of the realm of philosophy and became scientific or mathematical, and answers were then spun. We arrived at answers. And so there's a certain validity to the argument that I hear. I take it seriously enough that I was really exercised in trying to answer it, because I do think there's some validity in saying as science grows, philosophy shrinks. But I don't think it shrinks to the vanishing point. And the other thing I really wanted to argue is that there is philosophical progress as well, on a par with scientific progress, and we don't see it because we see with it. It becomes part of our intuitions. So in bringing Plato back into our day, and that's, part of the shtick that I do, he's constantly surprised, not just by our science and technology, but our ethical intuitions. What, no slaves? that didn't occur to him, that there ought not to be slaves. But it's what is intuitively obvious to us took philosophers a long, long time to establish.
As we have these debates on religion and morality and politics, and the science becomes stronger and the science becomes more dedicated, doesn't that kick into gear even more the philosophical questions of, okay, you can do this, but should you do this?
Well, there's definitely that. There's, is there certain technology we simply shouldn't develop just because we can? So that kind of question, are there certain conclusions, certain research that we perhaps shouldn't even undertake because the conclusions would jar us? I tend not to be sympathetic to that latter. I think that, in fact, good philosophy is always based on our best knowledge of what the world is like. And, I don't think we should be afraid of scientific research that will show us the world doesn't exactly conform to our intuitions. I think it's always good philosophy to make our intuitions confirm to the world rather than the other way around. Also, I think, you know, and I think this is part of your question, that philosophy is always busy because as science, you know, discovers more and more, and in my last chapter, Plato has a brain scan, and he talks to a neuroscientist who knows a great deal about the brain, and he knows where various, you know, functions are located. And this neuroscientist thinks he's answered the question of free will in the negative, a question of moral responsibility, a personal identity. There really aren't any persons. There are just, you know, 3 trillion synapses firing away with no sense of the whole. And I think part of what philosophy has to do is to mediate between what science is telling us and other knowledge that we have that we need in order to live coherent lives, ethically and in other ways, coherent lives.
You referred to it as shtick a moment ago, but you do write in the book about what Plato would make of Google. And it's an interesting issue because that whole notion that we can find out anything we want by simply putting in a question and getting an answer instead of having it reasoned out by an expert.
Yeah. So the notion of crowdsourcing. So he goes to the Googleplex in Mountain View, California. I've been there on an author tour, and I'll be there next week again with this book. And he gets, but I have my Plato not only acquire a Chromebook or, you know, a computer so that he could get up to speed on everything, because I didn't want to have to explain everything to him, but he becomes very infatuated with the Internet. But he gets into a conversation as to whether or not these ethical questions can be crowdsourced, and we can come up with an algorithm the way Google has come up with an algorithm to deliver you know, our information to us in the most efficient form. That's how Google became the incredible force in our lives that it did. And he argues against this, that ethics can't be crowdsourced, that it takes a kind of expertise, an ethical expertise. That is something he was very committed to, Plato. The other thing that I thought was interesting was Plato was, as I mentioned, he's at first infatuated with the Internet. I mean, to have all of this information, all of this knowledge available is a philosopher's dream. But he, and also that there's dialogue going on the Internet, that there are blogs that were speaking to each other, and Plato so believed in dialogues. He wrote in the dialogue forum, but he thought the most important way of testing our assumptions is to air them in the climate of opposing viewpoints. So dialogue is very, very important. But he becomes more and more disillusioned, and I have him going on Fox News, and there's his ultimate disillusion. He becomes more and more disillusioned with how we're using our technologies, that we're actually speaking to those who agree with our assumptions. And even worse, we're getting our news from news sources that agree with our assumptions. And he thinks that's very, very dangerous to our democracy, as I do.
I suppose this is where my surprise came, as I was telling you at the beginning of our conversation, that there seems to be such an elasticity to the arguments and to philosophy as a whole that it fits so well to many of these ideals and issues that we're confronting today.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think one of the points I try to make in the book is that our age has a lot of parallels with the extraordinary age in which, you know, philosophy emerged in, you know, ancient Greece in, you know, roughly the 6th to 4th century. And that was also the time when the great religious traditions emerged, roughly really 800 to 200 BCE. The religious traditions that still persist today, the Abrahamic religion and Confucianism and Zoroastrianism and Hinduism and Buddhism and Confucianism. And I'm sure I've left some out, but also Greek philosophy. So these big questions of what is, you know, what do we do to attain a life that matters, emerged during this period. And I think they are reemerging with a new, I know, force and poignancy in our own age, and I think because of the growth of secularism, that religion for a very long time provided the answers, and it doesn't do it on the same level for as many of us as it had for centuries. And so the philosophical questions of, you know, how do I acquire a life with meaning and that matters, have taken on, once again, a new force that make us very philosophical, very primed to get back to philosophy and see what are the answers that have been worked out there.
I love that you use the word primed, because it seems in our technological world that we are very willing to share, we are very insular, and we tell a lot about ourselves, and it seems that the next step would be a logical step to be, okay, but what does this mean? What does this mean for me, and what does this mean for us all?
Oh, exactly. And that is, it's really interesting, because the pre-philosophical Greek society, against which Socrates and Plato rebelled to a certain extent, was a celebrity society. They they really felt that acclaim and fame was a way of giving your short life a moreness, you know, just some more substance. If you can have your life replicated in the minds of as many other minds as possible, that would somehow help you defeat death, you know, so fame and acclaim. And that was and Socrates and Plato really rebelled against that and said, no, you know, the acclaim of others is not going to really do it for you. Let's think about it. Having a meaningful life is something that you have to make for yourself, that you have to think about justice and wisdom and how we acquire these things for ourselves. And justice, of course, requires us to think about others as well. And this notion, the notion of claim, which in Greece was called, in Greek was called kleos, reminds me a lot of our notion of clout. You know, what is your influence on the social media? How many tweet followers do you have? How many Facebook likes do you have? The more our own lives are replicated in the lives of others, the more they know that we exist, the more we feel like we matter. There is such a parallel between the conditions that prompted the emergence of philosophy, and I think therefore ought to prompt the reemergence of philosophy, taking what the philosophers have been working out, again, over the centuries, to try to reassure us that our lives really do matter, we can calm down a little bit, that we all matter in exactly the same way. That in itself is a step towards justice and wisdom, and acting on that knowledge, making sure that every life is given the means for full flourishing, that every life matters, and therefore every life ought to be treated accordingly.
And it's one thing to say that we can do that, but does culture reinforce that?
Exactly. Well, we're up against some challenges. There are the challenges. But how stunning it is that our, you know, with the sort of eclipse of the theistic answers to the old existential questions, that what emerged is exactly the same kind of answer that created the preconditions for philosophy back in, you know, 2,400 years ago. How amazing.
The book is fascinating. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. It's Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. It is published by Pantheon. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A delight to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for dialoguing with me. It's all about the dialogue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your conversation. Again, the title of the book is Plato at the Googleplex. It's published by Pantheon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.